dynamic part of the protest march demanding the end of evictions and official documents for everybody. Thousands died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. Those who succeeded this dangerous adventure became undocumented workers in Europe and faced the risk to be sent back every day.
Yesterday, Macron spoke to the African and French youth about culture, sports and entrepreneurship. My question to him would have been, how can we be partner with France or Europe, given their policy which cost the life of 2,000 young Africans in the Mediterranean Sea only during the last 8 months?
President Macron says he wants to change the relations between France and African countries, but the pretty words at the official summit do not hide the facts on the ground. Undocumented workers have been arrested upon arriving here in Montpellier and received orders to leave the territory. Macron, with his anti-migrant policy, continues fishing in the waters of the racist far right. And that's a dangerous game. Christian Hunt, Montpellier.
Campaigners outside the Liverpool City Council, opposing an upcoming arms fair in their city, home to people of Yemeni and Palestinian heritage.
We are a safe haven and we are a safe place for refugees and people fleeing war. So why are we, on the one hand, being a refuge and on the other hand, selling the weapons that are causing the destruction to life and land and liberty?
The arms fair is set to kick off here in a few days, showcasing plane and missile components, drones and other military hardware. The building is owned by the city council that campaigners say has refused to cancel the fair despite months of protests and petitions.
I think we have a very right-wing council. They have a mask, they wear a mask, and they try to face both ways. They call themselves socialists, but they implement cuts to vulnerable people. They don't oppose the Tory cuts at all. And more shockingly than anything, they have said they are powerless to stop the arms fair.
Starting on October 12, the fair will provide a venue for some of the world's most notorious weapons makers, the UK's BAE Systems, which has made a bomb selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the Emirates to be used against Yemenis. Elbit Systems, a UK-based Israeli company accused of testing its deadly armaments on Palestinians. And American firm Raytheon, also a major supplier to Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
For the last 20 years, Britain has participated in a series of absolutely catastrophic wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, that have caused murder and mayhem around a huge arc of the world. And we really need that to change. And unfortunately, at the moment, our leaders are refusing to learn any lessons from those disasters.
Today's protest follows days of similar action against one of the world's largest arms fairs held in London just last month. And they're all calling for an end to arms exhibits in the UK and the government's unquestioning support for arms exports. Saeed Purriza, Liverpool.
The Boycott Divestment Sanctions Movement, also known as BDS, has called for a boycott of the ongoing Dubai Expo. BDS is a transnational Palestinian-led organization that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressures Tel Aviv to comply with international law. The delayed Dubai Expo 2020 kicked off on October the 1st and will be held over the course of 6 months. It is the first time that such an initiative is taking place in the UAE, according to BDS. Both the UAE and Israel are shamelessly using the World Expo to whitewash and distract attention from their dismal human rights violations, war crimes in Yemen, and the criminal oppression of migrant workers.
BDS urges to boycott political, cultural, sporting initiatives used by Tel Aviv to show that Israel is a country where peace and harmony rule and there is no system of oppression against Palestinians.
The Dubai Expo has been awash in controversy since day one, with the European Parliament urging nations not to take part in the initiative. The legislative branch of the EU has cited human rights abuses, the jailing of activists, and the autocratic government's use of spyware to target critics.
EU Parliament's calls to withdraw from Dubai Expo 2020 also included the main sponsor of the initiative. According to Palestinian citizens residing in Italy, the EU could take a much firmer stance towards holding the UAE government accountable for its ongoing systematic oppression of Palestinians and its utter disregard to international law.
The EU should boycott Israel in the first place. If Brussels really believes that the expo has to be boycotted, it should say it more clearly. The EU always has a double standard when it comes to the Arab world.
The Dubai Expo takes place against a backdrop of a growing UAE-Israel military security alliance, starting with Abu Dhabi's import of billions of dollars worth of Israeli security and military technology in recent years. Max Civili, Rome.
Barricaded and heavily guarded, the shore forged by the local government against peaceful protesters who want to present a memorandum at U.S. Consulate for the release of Pakistani neuroscientist Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who was kidnapped along with her three children by the FBI agent with the assistance of the local secret services. Protesters are outraged over what they call the Khan administration's failure to stand by its promise to bring Dr. Afia home. She had been sentenced to 86 years in prison by the U.S. Afia protests coincided with the arrival of U.S. Deputy Secretary Wendy Sherman and her seven-member delegation exempted from the COVID-19 rapid antigen test and body scanning on arrival.
Our establishment is so in awe, it's awe-stricken with America, that it won't even let a peaceful delegation go to this, to just send a memorandum, that's all. It goes to show that the Tehreek-e-Insaf establishment has nothing to do with Insaf.
Heavy contingent of police was deployed to stop the march miles away from the U.S. consulate.
This is a peaceful demonstration. We just want to go to the American consulate. We just want to submit a memorandum in which it is written that Afia is innocent. The war is over. The American forces have flown back. We have given safe passage. 5,000 Americans and NATO soldiers in negotiation. We can't even bring our daughter back.
Later, two members of the protest were allowed to submit their memorandum.
This is just for the security purpose. We have stopped them here. And now a small contingent of their is moving towards the consulate to present a memorandum of the protest to the consulate.
Although U.S. war in Afghanistan is over, but with broken promises by repeated Pakistani governments, Afia's family doesn't seem that lucky. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
Amid the pressures of the rolling COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns, members of the biggest union federation in South Africa have come out into the streets to demand a living wage for the working class. Not only have workers faced retrenchments, but corruption cases among top officials have exacerbated the situation. In one incident, the health minister at the time the pandemic erupted was replaced amid charges of corruption, in which millions of dollars meant to help curtail the virus was siphoned for personal luxuries.
Workers have borne the brunt of corruption with retrenchment and loss of wages in SOEs, loss of wages in municipalities, and assassinations of whistleblowers, wage freezes in the states, freezing of critical public service vacancies in frontline departments, the deterioration and collapse of key public service and austerity.
Workers say the private sector has equally shown growth despite the apparent slowdown. Auditing firm PwC has described 2020 as a banner year for South Africa's mining sector, which is a mainstay of the economy. Yet workers, often those earning the lowest, had to endure cuts to their salaries. Government departments, meanwhile, have frozen salary increases.
So the municipality here must pay what is due to members, to workers, as it is, comrades. If they want to exempt, they must exempt their own salaries and leave the income of workers who wake up in the morning to clean this city.
With municipal elections scheduled for next month, workers are shoring up support to have their voices heard and to garner the best from whoever takes over the local administrations. As many sit at home without jobs, they have vowed to come out onto the streets again until the demands are met. Hassan Sirip, Cape Town.
For a time too long, Lebanon has been mired in a deep economic crisis. The World Bank says Lebanon's current crisis is possibly among the top three worst crises the world has seen in 150 years. Here is a list of numbers. The currency has lost over 90% of its value since 2019. 78% of the population is estimated to be living in poverty, and 36% are grappling with extreme poverty. Experts put the fault on economic mismanagement and corruption. Also to blame are foreign interventions and sanctions imposed by the United States and its allies to punish Lebanon for the influence the resistance movement Hezbollah enjoys in the country's political structure. Chronic political instability in Lebanon has further exacerbated the crisis. Add to this the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut that inflicted billions of dollars of damage. The situation has led to severe shortages of medicine and fuel and power cuts. The United Nations has sounded the alarm over the dire economic situation and rising hunger in Lebanon.
The situation remains a living nightmare for ordinary people, causing unspeakable suffering and distress for the most vulnerable. Starvation has become a growing reality for thousands of people.
Fortunately, the Lebanese have been hearing some good news for a while. Iran has started exporting fuel to ease the energy crisis. So far, several shipments of fuel have entered the Arab country under a deal arranged by Hezbollah, which has called this a break of the American siege. And last month, a new government was finally appointed, ending 13 months of political wrangling. Earlier this week, Lebanon restarted discussions with the International Monetary Fund after a more than a year-long hiatus to arrange a loan. And now, Iran is assuring the Arab nation of its full support. The Iranian top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdollahian has visited Lebanon, saying Tehran is ready to help with development projects in the Arab nation. Specifically, he said Iran is ready to build two power plants in Lebanon and help rebuild Beirut's port. And Lebanese officials have welcomed this. In a meeting with Amir Abdollahian, President Michel Aoun commended Iran's support for Lebanon and the measures the Islamic Republic has taken to help the nation overcome serious challenges. All this raises hope of better days for crisis-hit Lebanon.
A family saga spanning some 20 years. Dubai's autocratic ruler Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum and his ex-wife, Jordan's princess, Haya, fighting over the custody of their two daughters in UK courts. The UK High Court has ruled that during a crucial phase of the hearings, Al Maktoum ordered the phones of his former wife, her personal assistant, her security and legal team, and that of her barrister, who is a member of the House of Lords of the British Parliament, to be hacked. Princess Haya fled Dubai 2 years ago, after she learned of her husband's abduction and mistreatment of their two daughters. In the UK, she applied for court orders to prevent her children from being returned to Dubai.
The judgment that was handed down in the court behind me revealed how Dubai's 70-year-old ruler, a close ally of the UK, abused his power and breached UK criminal law in order to snoop on his wife and the people around her.
The intrusive spyware used, Pegasus, developed by the Israeli regime's NSO group, touted as one for fighting terrorism.
What we've seen here is confirmation of what has been suspected for many months, at the very least, in terms of this particular software to combat terrorism, but then being abused to further personal vendettas.
It was the same spyware that the Sheikh's henchmen used to track down one of his daughters, Sheikha Latifa, in 2018, when she tried to flee Dubai on a boat.
When a head of a friendly state is without authority, breaking the law in the United Kingdom in such a blatant way, and even threatening his own family. For example, we've seen in the past, of course, where he's alleged, with quite considerable evidence, to have even kidnapped his own daughters, and kidnapped from, effectively, the United Kingdom. That did not prevent these close ties from remaining, perhaps even being reinforced.
The UAE is home to more than 500 British businesses and more than 120,000 Britons. It's a UK-made weapons client. Sheikh Mohammed Makhdoum is a billionaire racehorse owner with strong ties with the British establishment. He also owns a property empire in the UK. He's been photographed with the Queen and, above all, has sovereign immunity from any future possible prosecutions. But UK law has been broken here, and this case poses extremely awkward questions about one of Britain's closest friends in the Middle East. If campaigners say where money is involved, the British establishment is prepared to look the other way. Saeed Pourriza, London.
Iraqis are heading to the polls for an early parliamentary election following demonstrations that started in central Baghdad back in October 2019 to demand the resignation of the government. They have been calling for better services and an end to what they say is wide-scale government corruption. We headed to the same location where the rallies, also known as the Tahrir movement, first started.
We're at Freedom Square, or Tahrir Square as it's known locally here. This is where the protests began back in October 2019, a protest movement that led to the early elections. And we're going to talk to some individuals on the streets here to find out what their expectations are from the new government.
What I want from the new government is just make new opportunities to opportunities jobs for young people.
The most important issue is to clean the country's streets, Baghdad, other cities. The leaders should be trustworthy. We don't want to repeat this election every day.
We just need the basic service for Iraqi people, and we need the work. That's it. That we don't need anything more.
We have a demand from the new government to expel the American presence and the Israelis than any interference by regional countries.
And this is why the government has decided to call for an early election where around 25 million voters are eligible to cast their ballots for some 2,300 candidates in parliament.
Many challenges await the new Iraqi government, and the protest movement itself can play a major role by reshaping the direction of parliament, in addition to the many independent candidates that are running. But the other parties also maintain massive support within Iraq. Wissam Bahrani, Baghdad.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, millions of British people could fall into fuel poverty this year. That means that some would have to cut back on the basics in order to be able to heat their homes. This gas shortage and price rise follow empty pumps at petrol stations, where due to a shortage of truck drivers, Brits have had to wait in long lines to fill up their cars. Even the government has brought the army in to drive trucks to try to fill the supply gap. But all of it seems to be pointing to mismanagement by the government. Stay with us as we take a look at it all on this spotlight. Let's cross over to London, start off with Amina Taylor. Amina, give us your take. What's going on?
Yeah, this is shaping up to what some commentators are saying is a return to the bad old days. The old phrase, winter of discontent, being thrown around here, because not only did you have those rather unsavory scenes of empty fuel pumps and consumers queuing up to get a little bit of petrol for their cars if there was any to go around, you're also combating and trying to balance that with issues in the breakdown of the fuel supply train. You're also looking at a situation where energy firms, some of the smaller ones who were able to perform and provide a little bit more competition in the market, going bust. So on one hand, you have fuel issues at the pumps, and at the other hand, you're looking at fuel issues for the homes. And as always, you have the most vulnerable consumers having to deal with some very real crisis-making decisions about whether or not they can put food in their bellies, food in the bellies of their children, or perhaps provide fuel for their vehicles to get to work, to get to some crucial jobs, or to heat their homes. So I think many of those who would have listened to the Prime Minister's speech a little bit earlier in the week will be wondering what parallel universe Boris Johnson is living in, when so many of his subjects will be wondering just how they will make it through the winter this month. And unfortunately, I believe this is just the beginning of things to come, and unfortunately not the beginning of the end.
Well, I mean, just staying with you briefly, because the Prime Minister has tried to show a brave face and said that things are getting better. I mean, your assessment of people's reaction on the ground, I mean, do they believe this? Do they believe that things are getting better, or are they feel that it's getting worse?
Well, they don't have to believe if it's getting better or worse. They just have to look at the realities on the ground. And even though one might think that the Conservatives would be a bit further behind in the poll, they're not, which tells its own story. But it's also about when this starts to bite a little bit more, because even if individuals didn't have the major issues with their vehicles, maybe these individuals will not be affected by the rise in domestic fuel prices just yet for their homes. When some of these price caps go and people are renegotiating the cost of energy to their homes, they'll really start to feel that bump. And we're talking about hundreds of pounds for even the most conservative estimate here. So unfortunately, it's not a matter of whether they have an impression of what's going on. The reality will soon come to bite, unfortunately. And it's those lower to middle income families that will feel it the most. £400 is nothing to somebody who's earning a lot of money. But believe me, when you're already counting every pennies, this is just enough to push you over the edge.
Thank you so much, Amina Taylor, correspondent in London, for that report. I'd like to welcome out of London now author and historian Marcus Papadopoulos. And out of Edinburgh, writer and political analyst John White.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us to start this off. With Marcus out of London. I mean, Marcus, the government says the fuel crisis happened because there were not enough drivers to supply the service stations. But did the government not calculate this ahead of time? I mean, why was the situation allowed to reach such a critical point?
Well, I should first of all start by saying that, currently speaking, there is no energy crisis in the UK. Further to that, there is no food crisis either. Recently, I travelled from London to Pembrokeshire, stopping off at numerous places along the way. I saw no signs of an energy crisis. I saw no signs of food shortages in any of the supermarkets which I visited. It is certainly the case that a couple of weeks or so ago, people were stockpiling petrol or diesel, And that did cause a short-term problem. But the people who were stockpiling petrol or diesel did so on account of mainstream media outlets in the UK putting out completely uncorroborated, unsubstantiated stories saying that there will be a petrol crisis in Britain. I would also add as well that it is certainly the case that many of these aspects have been mismanaged by the current government. But then this is a problem that has been plaguing Britain for many years now. So we hear about how there will be in Britain this winter a rise in electricity and a rise in gas. But year in, year out, there is always a rise in energy prices in Britain.
So Marcus, are you saying this has been created? I'm sorry to interrupt you. So are you saying that this has been created by the media? And if so, why?
What I believe is that British mainstream media is depicting something in order to distract the British public from a lot of very serious problems at home. It is certainly the case that the British government has relied too extensively on liquefied natural gas. Also, the British government should have put politics aside and should have sat down with the Russian government and secured an energy deal with Russia, which would have resulted with an uninterrupted flow of Russian natural gas. But alas, the British wanted to put politics first, and as a result, if there is to be a shortage of gas this winter in Britain, that will be the fault of the British state, and the ordinary British man and woman will pay the price. And it goes back to what I said moments ago. There is always a rise in the UK every single year in the price of gas and electricity. Why? Because energy was privatised many years ago in Britain. Why is it that people in Russia do not struggle to pay their gas bills or their electricity bills? Why? Because electricity and gas has been state run. It is not, electricity and gas does not exist in Russia to make a profit. It exists to provide people with electricity and gas. The same cannot be said, alas, in Britain.
Right,
electricity and gas is used by the British state to make money. Like public services in Britain are used by the public state to make money.
All right, stay with me. I mean, because I think we're going to get into the whole, then we look at neoliberalism and what has happened in the West because of those policies. But let me get John in on this conversation. John, your take, you heard what Marcus said, that basically this has been something that has been exaggerated because basically there really isn't a crisis. What do you think?
There is a crisis. It's a global crisis. Excuse me, I've just changed position. The light's in the way here. It's a global crisis caused in large part by the surge in demand for fuel post-COVID by economies all over the world. But Brexit has exacerbated that crisis due to the supply chain issues created by Brexit. The just-in-time supply chain system adopted by the UK has broken down because the importation of vital supplies and basic necessities have been interrupted by increased custom controls and bureaucracy. So there is a multiplicity of crises, and the UK has been in the eye of a storm because of COVID, but also because of Brexit and all the problems that it has unleashed.
Okay, and hopefully we will establish that video connection right now. That was, of course, the voice that you could hear of John. Hopefully we'll establish a better connection. I mean, Marcus, you say that basically you had driven through the country and you went to various stores, and you did not notice it. So tell me about when we have been seeing long lines at petrol stations. We have been shown shelves that have been half empty, and we've had people actually had interviews in the UK with individuals on the street that are complaining about the current situation. I mean, what do you say to this? Hasn't the country gone from crisis to crisis, or do you not see it that way?
Well, I must first of all clarify something. There is no global energy crisis. Such an argument is completely untenable. For example, there is no energy crisis in France. There is no energy crisis in Germany. There is no energy crisis in Italy. Indeed, there is no energy crisis anywhere in Europe. Why? Because Europe or the European Union and also individual countries which make up Europe have secured concrete agreements with Russia to receive an uninterrupted flow of gas. Those governments put their people first by wanting to ensure that their industries and domestic households would not be left without electricity or gas at any time of the year. Now, returning to the UK, yes, it is certainly the case that for a few days there was a shortage, and I have to use the word shortage in a very loose way, a shortage of petrol and diesel, not because there was a lack of petrol or diesel in the UK. It was because British mainstream media was putting out stories, as I said moments ago, completely unsubstantiated stories, which caused panic. And as a result, people were stockpiling petrol and diesel. People were going to their local petrol stations. They were taking jerry cans with them. They were filling them up. And that was causing a short-term problem. But that only lasted for a few days. Furthermore, it is the case that in some areas of the UK, supermarkets were not bare. They were not empty, but there were certainly products which were not available. But that was only a few cases. However, British mainstream media has depicted a completely false picture by saying that the whole of the UK is experiencing a shortage of energy and a shortage of food. That is simply not the case. And I believe that part of the reason for this false portrayal is to distract the British people from some very worrying developments at home. And I'm specifically referring to these changes which the British state is imposing on the British people vis-a-vis what is known as COVID-19. But there are also many other problems in Britain. For example, there are 14 million people in Britain living in poverty. That includes 4 million children. 4 million children living below the breadline. Now, one of the tactics the British state has used over centuries to remain entrenched in power is to distract the average British man and woman from what is happening in their society.
Okay.
So, for instance, they will say that Russia is causing the energy crisis. They will say that Russia is a threat to the freedom and democracy of Britain, because they are distracting the British people from the terrible measures and the terrible problems which are plaguing the British people.
Okay, stay with me, Marcus. Let me get John back in on this. John, your take, you were shaking your head partially while Marcus was speaking. Your take on this, so go ahead.
This is not a crisis that's being fabricated by the British mainstream media. There is a material crisis. It's largely a result of the post-COVID demand for energy around the world, especially on the part of the Chinese and Indian economies. European countries are suffering fuel shortages, but not to the same extent as UK because of Brexit, and also because they have larger and better storage facilities. For example, under the May government, the largest storage facility in the UK that could hold the gas reserves, the fuel reserves, for up to 3 months was shut down by Centrica, and now we only have the capacity to store fuel for 3 days. So that's had a material effect on the crisis. Gazprom is refusing to, or certainly up to now, has refused to go beyond the contract that agreed with the UK and other European territories for its supply. Putin recently voiced his opinion on the matter, saying that he will not let this crisis go to a certain point. He will look to increase production under Gazprom, which is a Russian state-owned energy giant. But there is a crisis globally because of the demand. COVID has accentuated that crisis. We have a crisis of haulage because of the shortage of HGV drivers, which is also part of the crisis because European drivers can't get into the UK as easily as they did under the EU. Northern Ireland is not suffering the same crisis because it still operates under the single market as part of the Northern Ireland Protocol. So I do respectfully have to disagree with the Thurston and Marcus's points on this matter.
Well, John, you feel that what you're calling these various crises, that it has been exacerbated by Brexit? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. We have different customs arrangements with the EU. We're not part of the single market. We do no longer have frictionless trade. Boris Johnson lied when he said that his deal, his oven ready deal, would still maintain frictionless trade. And so it's caused interruption in supply chains, and that has fed into a crisis. So as I said, there's a multiplicity of factors involved, but the issue is that Brexit has only sown dragon's teeth. Rather than free us from the clutches of the dictatorship in Brussels, as its main drivers would have maintained, Nigel Farage and the right wing of the Tory party, it has only made Britain isolated. And it just confirms that Brexit is an entirely misplaced understanding of Britain's role in the world in the second decade of the 21st century. It is an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Britannia ruled the waves and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased. And guess what? You can't eat a flag. A flag doesn't eat a hole. It doesn't put food on the table. And this is a result of false consciousness.
Marcus, your thoughts on that? I mean, do you feel that the Brexit has played a role in all of this? Or do you feel that all of this is part of what you said, basically just trying to deflect some other problems, more serious problems that are taking place there?
Well, as I said moments ago, Britain has relied on liquefied natural gas, and Britain should have looked to Germany as an example of ensuring gas, an uninterrupted flow of gas for British industry and households by securing an agreement with Russia. And in the last few days, we have seen a most bizarre chapter with British mainstream media. Because first of all, British mainstream media outlets were running stories saying that Vladimir Putin to increase the supply of natural gas to Europe to avert a crisis. Then within 48 hours or so, the same media outlets were saying that Vladimir Putin is going to decrease the amount of natural gas to Europe to instigate a crisis. It really is preposterous nonsense. I also do not believe it any role in this. I believe that whilst I support Britain withdrawing from the European Union, the European Union is not a socialist entity. It is a neoliberal, culture-hating, religion-hating. It's inflicted horrific damage on the lives of working class people across the European Union. One need only visit countries in Central Europe, such as Hungary and the Czech Republic, and in Eastern Europe, such as Romania and Poland, to see how factories have been as a result of the European Union. But it is most certainly the case, and I've been saying this for many years, that Britain is a country plagued by many illnesses, and this has been the case for centuries. Why? Because the British state, different to the lives of the ordinary British man and woman, wherever they are in the Union, in England, in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland, they simply do not care. And when I say the British state, I mean the British establishment, for example, the royal family and the aristocracy. For instance, energy should not have been privatised. Electricity and gas should exist to ensure that people do not go cold in the autumn and winter months. Electricity should exist to provide people with lighting at any time of the year. But because the British state values money above all else, it privatised energy. And it is absolutely true that for decades now, not just since Brexit, for decades now,
British people in the autumn and winter months have been fearful of putting on the heating because they are afraid they will not be able to pay their energy bills.
All right, let me get John in here because our time is running out quickly. But John, how is it that London still considers itself as Great Britain when it appears that it is getting more and more difficult for it to even keep millions of its people from simply freezing to death? I mean, it really does not sound like a first world country. Your thoughts?
Well, the British political establishment no longer runs an empire, but does operate under the illusions of an empire mind, and this is fed into Brexit. It has also managed to persuade a large swathe of working class people that the Union Jack is the way forward rather than class-based politics, which Marcus has eloquently laid out. I do entirely agree with the large part of the problem is not supply, it's ownership. Energy should be under state control. It's a necessity, it's a basic necessity. Privatization has been an unmitigated disaster. But the entire Western world is going through the same crisis of late capitalism. But the British state's answer to that crisis, which 2008 global economic crash, has been to withdraw from the world, withdraw from reality, and lose itself in illusions of grandeur based on a misplaced understanding of the British Empire, a failure to address the real history of that empire. So this is a problem of a lack of understanding of Britain's role in the world, a lack of understanding of the empire, or the British obscurantism fed by myths surrounding the Second World War and Britain's role in the Second World War, and the demonization of Russia.
Okay.
Russia is the biggest country in Europe, and the idea that you can isolate Russia, that you can have a Europe that's going to be stable without Russia being included as a major partner.
And on that note, I'm so sorry I have to interrupt. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me on the Spotlight. Marcus Papadopoulos, author and historian out of London. John White, writer and political analyst out of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Razia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. It's really hot in here. I'd better close the window and turn on the air conditioner.
heat intolerant. So this is the window and the air conditioner. So I was telling you that I'm heat intolerant, and guess what? Tomorrow I'm going to take a tour to Maranjab Desert, to one of the hottest regions of Iran in summer. If you could remember, we had been to Maranjab Desert once before. But our tomorrow's destination in Maranjab is its beautiful caravanserai. Stay with me. Maranjab Caravanserai is a caravanserai and a castle in the heart of the desert. This caravanserai is located beside Aran and Bitgul Salt Lake, north of Isfahan province. This caravanserai was built by the order of Shah Abbas Safavi in 983 Solar Hijri. This caravanserai, with an area of about 3,500 square meters, has 29 rooms. Maranjab Caravanserai is on the Silk Road and was used as a link road between Khorasan and Isfahan provinces. The roof of this caravanserai is built like watchtowers and used to have 500 armed forces who had the duty to provide the security of merchants and goods which used to be passed from China to Europe and vice versa. Maranjab Caravanserai also has a freshwater qanat. I'm driving to Maranjab Caravanserai. It's desert and desert as far as the eye could see. To be honest, I love the scenery. It makes me so calm. Around the road, there are different types of desert plants, including tamarisk, alhegi, I don't know the name of the rest. They look very strange to me. So here we arrived, and this is Maranjab Caravanserai. Magnificent! It's made of bricks, which is usually used as a construction material in dry regions. I am now in a corridor. On my left, there is a twisty staircase which reaches the roof. I want to go up in order to watch the sunset. And now I am in the big beautiful yard of Maranjab Caravanserai. At the center of the yard, there are benches and tables so that visitors can watch the beautiful starry sky of the desert at night. Around the yard, there are chambers for rent. These rooms are well furnished. Each room is separated from the yard's ground level by two stairs. I have rented the room on my right for a night. Oh, how beautiful it is! The ceiling is dome-like. There are niches on the walls which remind me of my grandma's old house. Very beautiful. I'm sure I would have a great night here in this caravanserai. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.